Thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figger. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Elizabeth F. Cohen. Elizabeth is associate professor of political science at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. She's a political theorist who works on normative questions about citizenship, sovereignty, rights, and political inclusion, among other things. Elizabeth's latest book is newly out with Cambridge University Press, and it's titled The Political Value of Time. Now, we're all familiar with some of the ways in which time figures into our political environment. Things such as term limits and waiting periods, deadlines, filibusters, and criminal sentences quickly come to mind. But in addition to these, there are also protocols, accords, mandates, contracts, and these frequently are temporally bounded in various ways. In fact, when you begin to think about it, it's a full range of political phenomena that are structured by time. And yet, oddly, time seems to have eluded political theorists and philosophers. Now, in her book, Elizabeth undertakes an examination of the role that temporality plays, particularly within liberal democratic polities. She develops a fascinating argument according to which time is both a political value and an instrument for distorting value. Now, there's a lot to talk about, and a lot of interesting issues emerge very quickly, but let's begin as we normally do with our guest. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Bob.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We usually start off with the author, so why don't we do that today? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm, as you said, political theorist at Syracuse University. I'm interested in topics related to rights and citizenship. My first book, Semi-Citizenship in Democratic Politics, also came out with Cambridge in 2010. And the kind of abiding theme of my work is the kind of interstices, what gets lost in between things. I am interested in these issues for normative reasons, and I'm also interested in them because I have a background of family that is deeply committed to social justice. I'm interested in citizenship in part because my family was left stateless after World War II, and so we never took our citizenship for granted. I'm also the daughter of a social theorist, and so I learned to think about these things abstractly at a young age.
Oh, fabulous. So why don't we get to the book? Now, I guess a natural place to start. So the book is about time as a substantive feature of the political order. And that time is such a feature. I think is kind of obvious in a way. once you hear it, like, oh yeah, of course. And you know, we don't have to think too hard to start thinking about all of the temporal dimensions of politics. And you're concerned, I think, in the book with the fact that despite its fairly sort of ubiquitous substantive role in the political order, it's largely been overlooked by political theory. So I guess sort of a two-part question. You know, do you have an account of why it's been overlooked? And secondly, maybe just a little bit more background on how you came to realize that it had been overlooked and decided to write on this topic.
Sure. Great questions. So I think it's Anthony Giddens, in describing what good social science should do, said that a good social scientists take things that everybody already knows or are really obvious and point them out to us, and describe them in ways that make them conceptually useful. And so, in thinking about time, it struck me that most of the things I say in the first two-thirds of this book are things that lots and lots of people who aren't even academics intuitively know. So we intuitively know that deadlines are really important and structure our lives in significant ways, and that there are deadlines given to us by the government. You know, if nothing else, we know April 15th, right? everybody's experiencing that pretty much. But others, you know, turning 18, turning 21, waiting for things is something that we experience universally, and we know it's important. It has an effect on us. And yet, we haven't necessarily thought about taking a long view of the ways in which states, and in particular, liberal democratic states, think about what these deadlines and these waiting periods mean and why they impose them and how they impose them. I don't particularly know why nobody else has written this exact book. I'm happy that they didn't, because it was fun to write. But there is some good work on time and politics that kind of I was able to embed this in or be in conversation with. There's some good work on in democratic theory. There's some good work on leisure and the importance of both leisure and just free time to being a good democratic citizen. There's some good work on the pace of politics that spans philosophy, sociology, and political theory, and how modernity has sped up our time frames and in some cases our time horizons. There's good work in international relations on time horizons as well, negotiation. And then lots and lots of work on capitalism and time, of course. So there is some thinking about time, but I did spy a kind of opening or an unexplored terrain when I started thinking about deadlines and waiting periods in democracy. And the kind of moment when I realized that I had a project actually came about as I was finishing the last bits. I think we might have even been in page proofs, the last bits of my last book, the semi-citizenship book. And for some reason, I was reading a case that is a British common law case that's really, really familiar to people who work on citizenship and would not be probably on the radar of anyone else. But it's called Calvin's case. Mm-hmm. It's a common law case. And Calvin's case is considered kind of the foundation of Anglo-American citizenship law for a bunch of reasons. It gets referred to a lot when we were establishing citizenship in the United States. And I just noticed that in Calvin's case, a distinction was made based on a date. So Calvin's case takes up the question of whether somebody who was born before the union of the English and the Scottish thrones, whether a person born before that union was actually a subject of the king. And it was questionable because, of course, you were supposed to be a natural-born subject. Mm-hmm. But you can't be natural born to something that doesn't exist yet.
Right.
And so the case actually sets up a barrier, a line in time before which you could be naturalized, but you weren't a natural born subject. And I looked at that and I thought, oh, you know, that date is a really important boundary. It's probably as important as any other type of political boundary we might have. But I can't find anything that's been written about that. And so I started thinking about that. And everything else kind of came out of reading that case.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, I will confess, I hadn't heard about the case prior to reading the book.
No reason you would have.
But, you know, the way that you present it, I'm like, wow, you know, that is a really interesting, and it's, I'm sure it's, you know, although it's a famous case, you know, it's once you start thinking like, well, wait a minute, you know, there are these sort of temporal, these lines drawn in the temporal field where you say, well, after this date, X, Y, and Z, before this date, none of those things. You say, well, you know, that is a really interesting, feature of all kinds of things that happen politically. You very quickly in the book introduce and then deploy the sort of three-way distinction or the distinction between three kinds of temporal borders or boundaries. These one-off fixed deadlines, as you call them, and then there are countdowns, and then there are what you call recurring deadlines. Maybe one place to begin to sort of get into the nuts and bolts of the account is to ask you to just sort of explain this sort of three-part menu.
Sure. So as I said, I started off kind of really interested in this idea that we could draw kind of line in the sand, a boundary using a deadline that was probably as significant for anybody living with it as a territorial boundary. And we do that with dates all the time. And there's all kinds of examples of this. So, we're dealing with a pretty significant immigration politics crisis. I don't know if we have an actual immigration crisis, but we have an immigration politics crisis going on in the United States and all kinds of concerns about undocumented immigration and talk about building a wall at the southern border.
Right.
I think there's even been talk about building a wall elsewhere too, but
the northern border.
As someone who lives close to the northern border, I'm not a fan, but I think most people who live close to the southern border are not fans either. But anyway, one of the facts that gets thrown in the face of this argument that we should spend a lot of money on a border wall is that about half, just under half of all the people in the United States who are undocumented have overstayed a visa. So they crossed the border perfectly legally and then went on to become undocumented because a border passed over them. And the border that passed over them was a temporal boundary. Mm-hmm. So they went from being in political sense, being legal and having certain types of claims against the state, even if they're not the same claims as a citizen might have, to being undocumented or in some people's parlance, illegal. And that happens because of a calendar and time passing rather than their own movement. There are other types of boundaries. I think one of the most significant are founding moments. So every state comes into existence, and if you look at constitutions and other types of founding documents, they almost inevitably refer to the moment that the state came into existence to identify when in time this thing actually started to be a sovereign state. And it's important to know that because, of course, as was the case in Calvin's case, it's the case very often in contemporary contexts as well, people who were a part of a political entity that existed before the founding of the state may not necessarily be included, even if they are the same people in the same territory with the same relationships to everyone around them. So we see these in constitutions, we often call them zero option rules. And you see them, saying something like, anybody here after this date is a citizen of this sovereign state. And then you'll see more complicated ones too. So German basic law is an example. Essentially the constitution of Germany that came into existence after World War II refers to people who had to leave during particular times in the previous regime, essentially in the previous state, and says kind of anyone here after this date, but also people who were here before this date had to leave or may have been here after this date. In other words, kind of re-including people that they had been told, the country had been told it illegitimately forced out of the country. You'll see the reverse as well in some of the post-Soviet republics. They wanted to de-Russify, and one of the ways to de-Russify is to point to certain dates before the Soviet Union resettled Russians in some of the subunits of the Soviet Union. They will refer to, okay, if your grandparents were here in these dates, you're good, but if you came during these dates and these dates, we think you're a settler and we're not necessarily going to honor your citizenship. So those kind of single moments, they're both really blunt instruments. You're kind of in or you're out, but there are these clever ways of using them to carve people in or out of a citizenry and a territory. We have other internal temporal boundaries, things like curfews, I think are really important. Depending on your age, your race, and your location, curfews can be quite significant temporal boundaries restricting free movement. People who have been convicted of crimes also deal with some temporal boundaries about how long they're able to travel and how far. Mm-hmm. So those single moments occur in lots and lots of ways that we often take for granted. Then we have these other types of temporal boundaries that I call countdowns. And a really good example of a countdown boundary is a statute of limitation. Mm-hmm. So a statute of limitation will take a point in time and say, you know, okay, crime committed, we believe was committed or was committed, we know was committed at this particular point. And we're going to say that the state can go after somebody for that crime for this amount of time. And so the clock is ticking on whether somebody can be prosecuted. And most crimes, it eventually runs out and then you're done. And the nice thing about a statute of limitation is that, you know, it gives us some leeway, right? There's a little bit of leeway for moving within those two periods of time. So you're not kind of run by the single date in the way that you are with a single moment temporal boundary. There's some flex in there. Mm-hmm. But it ends. Right. So it's really just two deadlines. That's not necessarily enough to say, like, this is really democratic procedure. So the third type of boundary is a recurring temporal boundary. And recurring temporal boundaries are those that we expect to go on in perpetuity with the same rhythm in a predictable fashion. And as you yourself said, a really good example is an election cycle, right? So we expect elections to be held for certain offices every thus and such amount of years. You know, presidency in the United States will, a president will be elected every 4 years. And these are really different. So, you know, a state is not a particularly democratic on its own entity. And so we expect sovereignty, I think, to kind of rule with more iron fist and be a single moment and very decisive in that way. Recurring deadlines are a democratic innovation because they allow us a period of time in which we can make decisions and then a moment in which we can remake them. And it's not until we get the idea of these recurring deadlines, that boundaries, that we can do democracy, I think. I don't think we can do democracy in an open-ended way. And so that's really, I think, opens up a lot of political opportunities for us.
Right. Excellent. So you claim that and claim in the book and have just claimed that these temporal boundaries figure into the founding and establishment of sovereign states in a way that is pretty tightly analogous to or similar to, let's just say, I don't know about analogous, to the role that sort of territory, sort of more sort of geographic or physical space does, that sovereign states have as part of their founding some delineation of where the state is in physical space. Can you tell us a little bit about this, the way in which these the temporal boundaries figure into the founding or creation of sovereign entities?
Sure. So as I said, you know, I think you'll see in almost any constitution, you'll see a reference to when the constitution goes into effect as well as, in fact, I based on the reading that I've done about territorial boundaries, I think we're probably much more certain of when states, assert themselves and say that they are states than we are about where the right. geographic boundaries are. And I just happened to be reading something today about Gulf states trying to dig canals around themselves to create a water boundary where none existed. And I've also been reading some really interesting things about climate change and boundaries, you know, territorial boundaries. Not only do we often ourselves not know where they are. So if I, you know, unless there's a marker, I'm going to go to the southern border of the United States and probably at many points not know which side of it I'm on. Certainly that would be the case in lots of different types of terrain around the world. But I'm much more, it's much, a much more precise thing to say that, like, I was, born at this moment, and at this moment, my parents were in the United States, or, thus and such person was born after the imposition of the French Republican calendar, which starts with zero and clearly creates a citizenry of the French Republic, that was different than what had existed before that. You see these, you know, Kuwait has like a really interesting nationality law that basically means you have to have had family there forever. Makes it very difficult for what has become a sizable guest worker population or their children to in any way claim that they might be citizens. So it enables their economy and their polity to kind of go on as if one weren't changing, when in fact their economy is very different now that they have so many guest workers. So I view these as very, very stark symbols of telling us kind of many things, but specific to what I want to do, who's in and who's out.
Right. So I take it that there's a similar phenomena or set of phenomena in play in the ways in which temporal boundaries work sort of internal to states. Now, we were just talking about, as you just put it, you know, who's in and who's out as a matter to be determined largely by some temporal discrimination. But just to get now into things like curfews and waiting periods, things having to do with working visas and permission to stay and the rest. Can you tell us a little bit about how these boundaries and borders work sort of inside? Because once we've got some sense of who's in and who's out, time still plays an important role, right?
Yes. And, you know, I think one thing to think about today in particular is this question. So we're really in a crisis with unaccompanied minors in the United States, and by which I mean not only people, young kids who crossed the border alone, but also people who are legally being stripped of their accompanied status by the government, taken away from their parents, and incarcerated separately. The reason that this was happening, the taking of the children, is because there's a rule in place that says that you can't, the children cannot be held for more than 20 days. It goes back to a settlement in the case known as Flores. And, so in order to indefinitely detain, right, the kids have to be separated from the parents, or everybody is supposed to be allowed to go to the check-in policy that we'd had before this. So that 20-day boundary is something that if you're the Trump administration and you're really trying to do zero tolerance, you've got to get around that 20-day boundary.
Which, and I understand they're trying to get around. I'm sad to say.
Yes. So they seem to have failed at their first strategy, which is to get around it just by separating the kids from the parents. Now they're asking, the Department of Justice is asking, basically for courts to let them ignore the rule. And I will make a kind of qualified guess that this is very similar to an emergency power. I read the explanation. It's very similar to an emergency powers type of request. In other words, they're saying, like, we have a crisis. We don't have a crisis, but they're claiming we have a crisis. And because it is an emergency, we'd like the court to tell us that we can lift this restriction and hold these people indefinitely. Right. But there was an attempt to put up a boundary there. We've got other types of internal boundaries as well. Another interesting one that is related to what's going on is quarantine. So immigrants, people coming into the country, we've seen this when people were, even U.S. citizens, traveled to places where there were concerns about pandemic, that they would be quarantined to not spread bird flu or, Zika, you know, things that can be passed. And so, well, quarantine, you know, has Latin origins, and it was in a period of time in which you would be kept by the government. As I said, also, you know, to people who have been incarcerated experience a ton of these internal boundaries where they not only can't go past a certain point without telling their parole officer or at all, but they have to check in every so often, or they can go away for only short periods of time. So they're really like all over the place once you start to see them.
Right. And so if I may ask, sort of waiting periods are sort of interesting sites, at least as you explain them in the book. And we can talk about ways in which certain maneuvers on the pro-life side of our abortion politics have been very interested in waiting periods and the pushback to those maneuvers. It does sort of recognize, you know, the way in which these, you know, fiddling with or manipulating these temporal borders does impact in some, you know, very significant way individuals' rights. You know, but another oddly, well, intriguingly, I guess, interesting place where sort of waiting period shows up is also in certain arguments about gun control. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where, you know, again, the, you know, if the state can make me wait for this, that's a roundabout way of denying me the right that is afforded in the Second Amendment, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me take a step back for a minute.
Sure.
and say that. So I started this project. I knew I had a project when I read Calvin's case, but I was really very interested in kind of, you know, democracies. And Calvin's case doesn't refer to a democracy. Those are sovereign subjects of a king. And I traced kind of some of the lineage, or I traced forward into the United States, looking at kind of what kind of influence this case had, why it's considered the origin of our citizenship laws. And I did two things. First thing I did was I started looking at kind of questions of citizenship right after the founding. Some of the cases don't kind of come up exactly at that moment. They take a while to work their way through, but they're really questions that arise when you've founded this new Republic. And one of the questions was like, well, what do we do about the loyalists, right? So these people are here and they fought against us. They were on the other side, but they're here. They're not like British soldiers that left and went home after they lost. And they have always been here. So we can't even say that like they're invaders or anything. What do we do? Are they citizens? And that's a really complicated question. So you know, for the Romans, it might have been simple. You give citizenship, but it is a really limited citizenship and very differentiated. And we were in some ways committed to not making those differentiations. And so a couple cases come through and courts are being asked, like, what do we do about these people? Are they citizens? And they come up with this remarkably consistent answer case after case in which what they do is they look to, was the person here when state and then our national constitution was proposed? And did they remain in that place, whichever state is in question and in the country, during the period in which we deliberated and decided to ratify? And the language is very explicit that these are special times of reasoning, that particular period marked out by two dates, and that anybody who was there had to have known that they were consenting to this because the whole country was involved in this national discussion about constituting itself. And so I saw that that was like a special period of reasoning. And reasoning is one of the words that comes up, that people were obviously being described as giving consent. And that's not that different than what we do, you know, when we elect, right? We know that there is an election going on. It's going to recur. It's not going to be the only election, but that that these periods of time are periods in which we can give consent. And we have all kinds of others. So you brought up abortion, and in fact, there have been successful attempts to put waiting periods into place to get people to reason, supposedly, to put the brakes on and make a reasoned decision about an abortion, and many other things. We think, you know, if we can create a waiting period for something, that lots of processes, but most importantly, consent. Consent cannot be given in a moment. That's the thing that makes Calvin's case so undemocratic. There's no consent at all about where you're born. It just happens in a moment, and it happens in a moment before we can reason. But once we have a period of time marked out by two dates, then, especially if we're adults, we're able to reason politically and then give our consent. And I called that, in the case of kind of ratifying constitutions, I call it lived consent, because we're just living through that period of time, but the living through it is significant.
Right, right. And I guess the idea that, just as you're talking, the sort of the tie between consenting and time, and that time can be a proxy or be a signal or be sufficient for a government to have, you know, to treat you as if you had consent. I guess this plays like sort of the tacit consent view in Locke, for example, looks like it's temporary. You know, we often talk, well, you've held property in the state. That's enough for, you know, on Locke's view, for you to have consented. But I guess the holding of property is at least in part a temporal phenomenon, right? So it looks as if it does have a sort of tacit consent has in that Lockean sense, does have a temporal dimension to it that, just another thing that I guess has been overlooked.
I think it has to, right? Yeah. I don't think, like, none of that, nothing significant to a democracy can happen in a moment. And, I kind of point out that there are arguments between, you know, the French philosophers. Condorcet is really concerned with this idea that democracy needs a rhythm. And we neither want to be too fast nor too slow, right? So for Condorcet, like, certain types of decisions require longer or shorter periods of time to make. And he has this whole theory of the rhythm of democracy that unfortunately, you know, did not get implemented in his time. But we think about this, you know, in our own context, sometimes explicitly, sometimes we're implicitly. But we know that, you know, the idea of any given leader suspending an election, for example, making us wait an extra cycle, that's undemocratic. And we know that if we're not given enough time to do something like register to vote or, you know, something, that these are undemocratic things because each process needs its due time. And that word process is really significant. I hang a lot in the book on the idea of process, that democracy requires us to experience and engage in various different types of processes, and that time has two different roles in that, right? So we know that there's a very concrete need for some time in order for a process to happen. So a process that I think is really important to becoming a citizen, either, you know, whether or not you were born somewhere, to really becoming a citizen is character development and learning. And you can go back into ancient philosophy and see versions of this, but you also, I think, can see arguments in the contemporary context about whether somebody is of a citizenly character. But it doesn't happen in an instant. It's a process that requires time. So too does gaining civic knowledge. So too does maturing. So too does the development of relationships with other citizens. You know, all of these processes require time. But it's also the case that they require more than time. And the things that they require that are beyond just like a period of time in which we sit there, those things are really, really abstract. We don't even necessarily agree on what they are. We might, you know, disagree wildly about what makes a good citizen. They're very hard to measure or test, despite what some people might like to do. And so in it, the time, which we know is required for them to happen, also becomes a really good way to represent those things that are otherwise so hard to make tangible and to represent. And so we might say, for example, let's take the probationary period that somebody who is not a natural born citizen waits before they naturalize. It's almost universal. In almost every country under almost any circumstance, somebody has to wait a period of time to naturalize, to become a citizen if they didn't start out a citizen. And, we don't agree on what's supposed to happen in that time period. We have a general sense, but, you know, the first Congress in the United States argued bitterly about it. And if we were to sit down and have a national discussion about it now, we'd argue bitterly. But we're actually pretty consistent about the idea that it happens in 5 years, and the 5 years, you know, it represents whatever it is we don't agree about, but it represents, if I think it's civic knowledge and you think it's like attachment to other citizens or work, we can go on living with each other just fine, even though we disagree, because I'm fine with 5 years of civic knowledge and you're fine with 5 years of these other things. So it becomes a proxy for things that a state otherwise really could not cope with measuring and sussing out and deciding about. So the waiting periods end up, you know, fulfilling both this very concrete instrumental role and this other kind of representational role. And that's, you know, has some downsides, but it is efficient. There's all kinds of benefits to that, too.
Sure. So this is a nice segue then, because, there's part of the book that is devoted largely to sort of describing the temporal mechanisms that are at work in, you know, the founding of states, the relations between states, and internal relations between citizens and states, and internal relations between citizens and citizens. But then there's also this discussion about time as a kind of value, and time as politically a proxy for values of other kinds, as you were just saying, that the waiting period, the probationary period for naturalization, we can agree on, you know, a particular probationary period, even amidst some pretty severe value-based disagreements about what makes for an appropriate citizen. I guess we could agree on a voting age, even if we disagree about what makes a citizen a competent voter or a proper voter. Can you tell us a little bit more sort of about both how time is a value and also how it serves as this, even in the cases we were just talking about, this, it's a value that helps us to address conflicts between or disagreements over values that look more unwieldy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say that, one of the core conclusions in the book is that time has value. It has, I try to kind of ease people into this idea who might not be comfortable with it by using this concept in Marx that a scholar who's worked a lot on time, Barbara Adam, pulls out very neatly. And that is that, in work itself is this unwieldy, irregular concept, you know, what constitutes work, what constitutes enough work, hard work, you know. But for Marx, we come to measure work in a way that we can then translate into paying somebody. We use time. So wage labor requires, you know, people to, you know, are working a certain period of time. And I just transition by saying this is the case for work, it's also the case for politics that we start to measure citizenship or citizenliness or being qualified to exercise a right. We start to measure that using time as well, because what constitutes being ready for citizenship, let's say after somebody's been incarcerated, is very, very difficult to say. But if we can just put an amount of time on it and say, like, we think that you will be, we don't even know, right? Are we rehabilitating you? Are we just keeping you out of society? Are we trying to punish and make you suffer? We certainly don't agree on that at all. But we do think we know exactly how long we need to do it for before you can become a citizen. And, you know, unfortunately, those lengths of time have become quite extended. But it regularizes that a process that would otherwise be very difficult, in the same way that time functions in capitalism to smooth out the rough edges of work. And so this gives us a baseline. And then what I point out is that one of the nice things about time is that you can kind of fiddle with it. So taking something like a prison sentence, we can make an equation first to come up with the sentence, like your background, past history of crimes, your age, the type of crime. We can kind of crunch a number there. But then we can also modify the sentence that we come out with something that's pretty qualitative, right, which is good behavior. Mm-hmm. So we can take a prison sentence of, you know, 10 years and say that this is the baseline sentence, but we're going to make an equation in which if you do these things, you're, you know, work in prison and do not get into trouble and show other exemplary behaviors, then we'll knock a certain amount of time off for those things. We do that with the naturalization formula as well, right? We believe that the baseline is 5 years between permanent residency and opportunity to naturalize. But we really think there's something special about serving in the military. And if you serve in the military, we'll knock a few years off your waiting period, because that's a very citizenly thing to do. And if you are on active duty, we'll actually get rid of the rest of your waiting period and let you naturalize. Something similar is the case for marrying a U.S. citizen. You can expedite. You still have a waiting period, but it's a shorter waiting period. If you're a permanent resident who is married to a U.S. citizen, because we really, really value marriage and families and the idea of kind of a you know, Burke's little platoon. We think that's really important to citizenship. So we can come up with these equations, some of which are quite simple and some of which are complicated, in which we take the quantitative thing that we use to represent other qualitative goods, and then we can modify it, both with something qualitative like an interview. You know, you do have to go for a kind of a character interview if you're trying to naturalize. And something quantitative also, like your score that you get on the citizenship test.
Right.
And these formula are all over the place. Like, we use these formula show up in lots and lots of different realms.
Right. So maybe that's a good lead into sort of one of the concerns that comes in later in the book, which has to do with time being understood as a kind of value neutral proxy for sort of competing value claims. Now, the way that you put this in the book has to do with, I guess, something that many of the listeners to our podcast will be familiar with, is sort of, you know, the longstanding debates about sort of liberal democratic states and the idea of you know, the need to preserve some kind of neutrality, whether that's justificatory neutrality or neutrality in some other sense is a debate. But the liberal state is supposed to, in some way, legislate and act politically in a way that doesn't presuppose or explicitly commit the state to some particular value orientation of the kind that, you know, citizens in a free state might reasonably disagree about. And so it looks as if time is the thing that we don't. There aren't reasonable disagreements about, you know, a week is 7 days and, you know, a year is 365 days and there's 12 hours in a, you know, in this segment of a day. So it looks then as if, and this is part of the analysis, right, that time has this sort of value neutrality, at least veneer to it. But you think that, in fact, that's more of an illusion, right?
Yeah, so I kind of preface this part of the book by just saying the reason we end up according time this value and this role is that we don't have a lot of good tools in a liberal democratic state for doing the kind of thing we need to do, which is very efficiently deciding who's qualified for rights and who's not. And, you know, at the micro level, it's something as specific as like one person's abortion, or at the macro level of like, when is somebody an adult? When are all people adults and things like that? And so, you know, we have all of these predecessor means of doing this. Like your blood lineage will tell you if you're a citizen in some context, right? You have the right blood, you're one of us. You don't, you're not. Money, property, very common in outside of liberal democracies as ways to determine who can have access to a right. You can buy your way in, or if you're propertied, you're considered citizenly. But if you want to be a liberal democracy, you need something that at least has the guise of being impartial and somewhat neutral, so that you are treating people according to the values that liberal democracy claims to commit. And so time seems way better. It's at first seems way better than money or property or blood lineage or any of these other things. Because everybody has time and the clock ticks at the same rate for everybody, as you said. So it has this kind of, seems to kind of be egalitarian and impartial. At the same time, it's almost unavoidable, there will be a pun.
Right.
But it is also the case that time's a little, it's embedded, right? Like, so every country has their own ways of thinking about time that are distinctly American or German or Italian. There's great historians of time. David Landis is a really well-known one. Vanessa Ogle, who talk about the creation of national time and what that means. And so we can kind of feel like we're doing something that only we would do as well. And very few things give us both that, you know, a way to call ourselves neutral and impartial and yet be very us and not anybody else. You know, that's a trick. And not much else can do that.
Can I just give one example of this? Because,
sure.
So I was last week, I was at an academic conference in Helsinki in Finland, of a group that in a previous year had met in Rome. And
that's, yes.
You can see where this is going. At the beginning or the introductory remarks at the conference, the organizers actually said, you'll be delighted by this, actually said, you're in Scandinavia now. Or you're in a, actually, I'm sorry. They said, you're in a Nordic country now. So,
yes, right.
So, we're going to stay on schedule.
Yeah.
And,
got it.
And this was
message received.
Yeah. And this was, you know, 100 or something people in the room, everybody understood exactly what the, we are in a Nordic country now meant. He didn't have to continue with the, you're going to stay on schedule. It was offered as a half joke, but that means half not joking, that it was going to stay on schedule. And that was just the right way to do things, maybe as such, but certainly it's the thing that will happen when you're in Helsinki, and
yeah,
didn't happen, I guess, in Rome.
I hope that somebody, just in solidarity with the Italians, stayed late with an espresso before a session was supposed to begin, just to kind of a little resistance, right?
It was interesting because there was a fairly regular reference back throughout the conference, like, well, you know, I see that some of our Italian colleagues are in the audience, so we're gonna give it another 3 minutes. I mean, it was interestingly embraced as a constraint, as part of a national character, as a difference between people who are situated in different parts of the world. It was interesting. Now that I'm thinking about it, like, well, it was really interesting that was just, you know, that was part of the conference, was that remark.
That's fascinating. I'm sure that we're probably, you know, experiencing these references more than, you know, we think we take some of them for granted, but that's a particularly pointed one, and I'm glad that everybody took it in good humor.
Right, but sorry, yeah. Please continue.
Well, so kind of, you know, I make a case for why we end up with time serving this role, you know, that it has all these different qualities. And then I use that as a jumping off point to talk about what I call the political economy of time. And that's the where I really get into these equations and what they mean. And I start talking about different examples of how we take periods of time and then modify waiting periods, how we represent, you know, different changes in circumstance that are, would be otherwise, you know, our rules would be too rigid to accommodate. And I talk about, you know, kind of how I think I'm not a heavy Foucauldian in any sense of that, but I use the concept of governmentality to say, like, okay, we kind of needed a political economy of time to go along with the other types of political economy that go into the art of government, just for practical reasons. But also, like, we kind of like the security of numbers. They feel very certain and clear to us. We like to quantify these things, and you can go back to, like, Plato and see that he also had this sense that we were going to have to do some kinds of commensuration. And that is, you know, using numbers to represent things that are otherwise hard to represent, and then using them a lot. And commensuration is really, really important. I think there's a great review article in one of the main sociology journals kind of about the study of numbers and how we're starting to, you know, not just be quantitative social scientists. And I hope your philosophy audience will forgive those, but I think they'll really find it interesting. Social scientists are using lots of numbers, but we haven't studied the use of numbers itself as much as we should. And we're just starting to. And one of the books by a sociologist named Wendy Espeland has been really important because she brings out the importance of commensuration. Commensuration is what's going on in Marx with wage labor, but we have a lot of forms of political commensuration that we haven't dealt with. And this is one form of political commensuration in which we use these numbers, this time, to determine who qualifies for rights. And what I do is I say, this is very similar to what Cass Sunstein, who I think will be familiar to your podcast audience, what Cass Sunstein calls incompletely theorized agreements, mm-hmm. in which we really can't necessarily agree on everything by in any stretch, but we can agree on some overarching, some superficials. So we don't agree on what happens during incarceration. We disagree very, very profoundly about what the purpose of incarceration is, but we can agree on how to do it, that we need sentences rather than, say, to torture people, you know, punish them in units of pain rather than units of time. Right. We can get that far, right, that we're going to incarcerate people rather than torture them. And these are incompletely theorized agreements because underneath the overarching agreement, there's just so much disagreement. And incompletely theorized agreements have some virtues, right? So they allow us to agree. They reduce the cost of the fact that we do disagree. They're loose enough that they allow moral evolution. So we may, in fact, do some sentencing reform, some more sentencing reform than we've done because what we did put into place didn't work very well. They you know, save us on time. And they're really well adapted to systems that rely on precedent as well. I also think that, you know, we've got some contradictory commitments in liberal democracies. Like, we like a demos, but we also think all people are fundamentally equal and you have to bound the demos, which means some people are not going to be treated as equals, even though we think they are equals. And these incompletely theorized agreements help us get around that. Without them, I think we'd descend into chaos and disagreement. There's some things people don't like about commensuration, though. It's very reductive, right? It's extremely reductive to reduce punishment and a crime to a prison sentence. People are often dissatisfied with that. Reducing maturity to the age of 18, I think we can see many instances in which people find that absurd, that we see people who are over the age of 18 who are incredibly immature. And as the Parkland incidents have illustrated, we see people under the age of 18 who are very much ready for citizenship.
Yep.
These are reductive. And, you know, communitarians, people like Michael Waltz are, you know, really, really don't like commensuration that much. so that's a problem. I kind of come down on the side that isn't as big a problem as somebody like Walter might think it is, because to get back to a point I made earlier, time has a lot of meaning. And so reducing, if we were to reduce the standard for citizenship to a dollar figure, we could get into what that money means, but it doesn't have the kind of meaning I think that time does to us. We're really, really emotionally and socially attached to thinking about time in certain ways. So we can smuggle more meaning in there than some of those critics who think time is very reductive. We can smuggle more meaning in than probably those critics are acknowledging. That time can be very rich.
For that reason, isn't there a problem, though? I mean, the more we thicken our understanding of the social meaning of time with, you know, sort of normative significance, then it does lose its ability to play this role as value neutral arbiter or commensurator of, you know, more seemingly difficult to tract value conflicts, right? And it looks as if maybe this is sort of an unmasking, kind of Foucauldian unmasking of something that's been there all along, which is that time, you know, looks like it's this value neutral thing. But in fact, what the state's doing in talking about these sort of temporal dimensions of, you know, when you're fit for citizenship, when you've, you know, repaid the debt to society that you created when you committed your crime. These are really just ways in which there's no impartiality at all. The value of time is a real thing and is as real as the value of, you know, being free from torture, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I come to this conclusion that there are points at which we can see time being, political time being manipulated by the state in ways that belie those beliefs we have that, you know, time, the clock is ticking at the same rate for everyone, and this is really fair. What I describe is that some people's time, it is devalued, and that we can see that somebody's time is being devalued when it turns out that they can't acquire rights at the same rate or pace in the same amount of time that somebody who's very similarly situated would. And so we can think of examples of this. We know that there's vast, vast racial disparities in our incarceration, sentencing and incarceration in the United States, and that somebody who is an African-American man is just much more likely to spend time in prison, but also spend more time than a similarly situated white person. So I can give other examples of this where somebody's time is being devalued, but I go back to the idea that the time represents important processes, character development, learning, the development of important relationships, citizenliness. Mm-hmm. And I say that once we devalue somebody's time and say, like, you know, you're not going to qualify for rights at the same rate as everyone else, we're essentially saying that they're not moral equals because time doesn't have the same effect on them as people or as citizens that it does on everyone else. And so if you have a person who's been sentenced to an extraordinarily long and longer than somebody else's similarly situated person's prison sentence, or if we have people coming into this country who in every way live like legal immigrants, they work, they pay taxes, they form families, they send their kids to school, in every way indistinguishable, but we'll never get to that point where they, the 5-year waiting period kicks in, that we are saying that there's something about having not had papers that makes them moral unequals. And that's really, if we buy the argument that the time was supposed to represent these important processes, if we buy that, then it's incredibly unfair, unjust to tell people who obviously have undergone those processes that they haven't undergone them and that they don't qualify for rights.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, you know, one of the real pleasures of the book, in those final chapters, is sort of seeing, wow, like, you know, time really isn't this neutral sort of thing that applies to everyone equally. And so, you know, 5 months here, 5 months for the next guy is just 5 months. You know, it seems like, you know, we have to give up on that. You've been very generous with your time, so to speak, and I want to thank you for that. The last question: this is a fabulous book.
And
it ends with some intriguing thoughts about further research. What will you be up to next?
Thank you. Yes, there's a couple things at the end of the book that have to do with kind of protest and slowing down politics in some instances. And I'm really hoping to be able to do some of that. But my most immediate next turn is I'm really interested in looking at the specific frame of line standing and line cutting as it pertains to social justice and distributive justice. And so we're hearing lots and lots of talk about immigrants cutting the line. Arlie Russell Hochschild wrote a whole book in which she talked about these disaffected people who would become Trump voters as viewing various groups, women, racial minorities, federal workers, as kind of cutting a line that they'd been waiting in to achieve the American dream. And I'm really interested in these metaphors about line standing, which is, of course, a temporal phenomenon, and what we think about the idea of first come, first served as a distributive principle. What it does to us when we start to think of ourselves as in line in a kind of very hierarchical relationship that allows for social mobility at a particular pace, but always places some people ahead of others. And then what we think of, what it does to us when we think people are cutting in line. So first of all, the line is a metaphor. It's not actually, there is no line. Mm-hmm. There's not even an immigration. There are some immigration lines, but there's not a line. And there's not one to cut into, certainly. But it does something to us when we think people are cutting in line. And everybody knows this because everybody has been in line. And although there are some societies that don't respect queues, many, many, many do. And for those that do, there's just a particular, incredibly powerful white hot rage that we experience when we think somebody has cut in line, even when sometimes we understand why they did it. And so I'm interested in kind of the political psychology of that. And I'm going to work with a political psychologist on that. And then also the normative dimensions of like why we so easily fall into this trap of liking first come, first serve as a distributive principle when, if you think about it, it's really not a very good distributive principle.
You mean because there's often the causal or explanatory chain about who's first often involves itself significant forms of injustice?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I was just at a conference in which we were talking about populism, and, you know, it's a great frame for populists because they can try and make themselves seem like they're native and that there's justification for their nativism just by invoking the queue and putting themselves at the head of the queue. But also, I actually think that if you take people out of the mindset of thinking about the queue and they kind of are able to either not have thought about it or wipe it from their heads and you start asking them, who should get what, they come up with much more nuanced views of who's deserving or who might need things, and that the queue doesn't leave much room for a principle like triage, which you see in an emergency room, right, in which you never are first come, first serve in an emergency room. The person there for the, you know, terrible head cold always gets seen after the person who came in with a gunshot wound.
Yeah.
And like, you know, we may be frustrated by that, but in the abstract anyway, we understand why that has to be. And so, you know, how can we kind of fight the frame, first of all, because I really care about politics, how can we fight the frame? But then also, how can we replace it with something that's more nuanced and better in the particular realms in which it has taken root?
Well, all that sounds fascinating. I will look forward to reading some work in the not too distant future, I hope, from you on these topics. But for now, I want to thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Well, thank you so much. It was really fun.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us for our discussion. Remember, I've been talking to Elizabeth Cohen, and her new book is titled The Political Value of Time. It's published by Cambridge University Press. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.